I want to share with you today a story of love and grace. Though we usually refer to the story as the prodigal son, it's really the story of a father, because a certain man had two sons. It could also be the story of a mother or a grandmother, grandfather, aunt, uncle, husband, wife, brother, sister, anyone. It's a story of anyone who loves enough to give of themselves more than they will ever expect to receive. It could be the story of my family. Maybe it is the story of your family. Perhaps the second greatest love story in the Bible. A father who shows love, mercy, patience, and grace to his sons. Sons who by words and deeds break their father's heart. But from the beginning to the end, the father never stops loving them, never stops demonstrating grace, nor finding ways to show them how much he cares, even though his sons could care less. The Bible says that love covers a multitude of sins, but in reality, love covers everything. Love suffers long and is kind. Love does not envy. Love does not parade itself. It is not puffed up. Does not behave rudely. Does not seek its own. Is not provoked. Thinks no evil. Does not rejoice in iniquity, but rejoices in truth, bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never fails. And grace is an expression of that love. Grace is undeserved favor, unmerited favor, getting that favor which you don't deserve. Grace is not free. In fact, grace costs everything. Even though our story has a happy ending, it's still a sobering story. The issues that are dealt with are as real today and as raw today as they were 2,000 years ago. They are the stuff of which life is made. So let's take a minute and pray. Father, we do lift up your word as it goes forward, Lord. Holy Spirit, we would ask that you would speak a word in season to everyone who sits here and give you the glory and the honor for all that we do and have, and as we gather as a body as well. So we're going to be in Luke chapter 15, starting in verse 11, and we're not going to leave there. In verse 11, it says, "And Jesus said, a certain man had two sons. And the younger of them said to his father, 'Father, give me the portion of goods that falleth to me.' And the father divided unto them his living. And not many days after, the younger son gathered all together and took his journey into a far country, where he wasted his substance with riotous living. The younger of two sons comes to his father and demands, 'Give me the portions that falleth to me.'" He demands from his father the inheritance that would come to him on his father's death. This crass young man insults and disrespects his father with his demands, as if to say to his father, "You are dead to me. I want what is mine, and I want it now. I no longer want to live under your roof or under your control or under your direction. It's my life. I want to live it as I choose. You can't tell me what to do." Who here has heard those very words? Who here has said those very words? So the father loves his son, and he grants his wish, and he divided unto them his living. He gives his son the inheritance that would befall him on his death. Notice that it says he divided unto them his living. His older brother, as firstborn and by law and custom, would be entitled to a double portion of the inheritance, two-thirds of this estate. The younger brother would inherit one-third of his father's estate. But again, that would only be on his father's death. Now we're going to draw some conclusions based on the story in its entirety. The father provided very well for his sons. The family is very wealthy. There are more than just a few servants tending to the family business. There are many servants that are paid in cash, hired hands, but there are also servants that are bond servants, and then there are those that are owned slaves. There are great fields where much food is grown. so plentiful that even the servants have more than enough to eat, and an abundance of cattle that's on hand that slaughter at any given moment. Great wardrobes of clothes, jewelry, and shoes in abundance, the family seemed to be financially comfortable and affluent. The younger son would have received everything necessary to start an independent life. This is what a father prepares for his children. So he would have been given servants, cattle, property, sustenance, money. This is the portion of goods that he demanded from his father. And in verse 13, it says, "And not many days after, the younger son gathered all together. He would liquidate all that he had received from his father into cash. He wasn't planning on settling down and starting a new life. He needed to travel light. He needed to travel fast. He would sell off everything he had that he couldn't carry with him, or maybe on a few animals. That meant that the whole town would know about the family's dirty laundry, because it would have been they who purchased the son's goods, which were rightfully the father's, and they would have been at bargain prices too. Think of the scandal and the ridicule of the father's reputation. He would hear the rumors and the whispers of his neighbors, the glances from the other men while at the synagogue. The older brother, he would not have been untouched either. He still lives at home, tending to the everyday operation of the family business. The loss of a third of the land alone would diminish the returns on his crops and profits. He has to deal with the local community. He would hear the rumors and whispers of his neighbors. He would also perhaps even overhear the servants talking about what the younger brother had done amongst themselves. And he took his journey into a far country, and there he wasted his substance with riotous living. Far away from home, into the abyss of discontent, where the grass is always greener. He has no trouble finding barflies and prostitutes to indulge his every whim. Sex, drugs, rock and roll, or what would be the equivalent back then. Friends, they were very easy to find when you're feeding their flesh, but they'll scatter like cockroaches when the money and the good times run out. All the while, when the younger son is in rebellion, the father is neither negligent nor careless regarding his younger son. The father knows the dangers and the pitfalls that await his son, but his son has chosen separation. He abandoned and walked away from his father's covering. Perhaps this father knows that this is the only way that this son will learn the lessons of life. And all parents must cross over and let their grown children live independently. It is not love to keep a controlling hand on your adult children. In verse 14, "And when the son had spent all, there arose a mighty famine in the land, and he began to be in want." Time is not mentioned in the verses, but again, we'll draw some conclusions. It takes more than a few days to spend and squander what certainly was a large sum of money. And famines, especially severe ones, they don't come overnight. Perhaps we are looking at 3 to 6 months, but it may have been as much as a year or more that the son was gone. But inevitably, the pot runs out. The pot at the end of the rainbow, it runs dry. The vast wealth that he arrived with is spent, and so goes his lifestyle, as his fortune. He's penniless, destitute, indigent. He finds himself in a severe famine. But he's not yet reached the bottom. Pride is still controlling his life. He says he began to be in want. He still thinks he can make this thing work. In verse 15, he says, "And the son went and joined himself to a citizen of that country, and the citizen sent him into the fields to feed the swine. And he would have gladly filled his belly with the husks that the swine did eat, and no man gave unto him." Where he had once been in the employ of his father, perhaps even working in the fields alongside of his brother, enjoying the privilege and prestige of the Master's son, with both the spiritual and practical blessings of the Father's house, he now finds himself at the extreme end of the spectrum. He went and joined himself to a citizen of that country. The color of the language is if the son had owed this citizen money and was indentured. Perhaps in his all-out spending spree, the son exceeded his tab at the local establishments. Bankrupt and on the brink of starvation, he is bound by obligation to work the lowest of jobs. The once prideful son who withstood his father face to face is now less than even the swine that he feeds. The pigs eat better than he does. In fact, the citizen feeds the pigs and lets the son starve. The bottom has finally come up to meet this son, and he has reached its inevitable conclusion with the wasting of his substance and riotous living. Verse 17, he says, "And when he came to himself, he said, 'How many hired servants of my father's have bread enough to spare, and I perish with hunger?' The fiery lust of the flesh have finally extinguished, and I don't think that mere hunger drives him home, but the stark realization that his actions have brought him to the brink of death." This epiphany is explained in the next few verses. In verse 18, he says, "I will arise." And I picture him lying face down in the dirt, collapsed from malnourishment, dehydration, physical exhaustion, pigs rooting all around his near lifeless body. Death is whispering in his ear. And I know that some of you may have even been in this place. With the last of his strength, he says, "I will arise, I will go to my father, and I will say to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and before thee, and I am no more worthy to be called thy son. Make me as one of thy hired servants.'" An agnostic does not recognize heaven or the God that he has sinned against. Nor the commandment of his God that says, "Honor thy father and thy mother, that thy days may be long upon the land which the Lord thy God has given thee." But the lessons and the training of his upbringing cannot be quenched, because they're not of the flesh. They are spiritual and core to his very being. The light of the spirit that he learned while in his father's house is beginning to shine again. His rebellion before his heavenly and earthly father is confessed. The son knows that he's unworthy. Pride no longer has any influence on him. The seeds of discontent are now ripe fruit on the vine. All that he took for granted, he realizes, is lost. Even his very life is in jeopardy. He rehearses his speech that he hopes will win his father's favor. "Father, I have sinned against heaven and before thee. I am no more worthy to be called thy son. Make me one of thy hired servants." No doubt he repeats it in his head over and over, trying to find just the right inflections, just the right cadence that will win his father's favor. He probably figures he only has one chance, and he's got to get it right. Who here is not guilty of the same thoughts when we do something wrong? What parent here has not heard the feeble excuse of a wayward child? What parent's heart doesn't hold on to the least possible glimmer of hope, hope that their child will turn back? Verse 20, he said, "And he arose." It's almost a resurrection of sorts. "And he came to his father. But when he was a great way off, his father saw him and had compassion and ran and fell on his neck and kissed him." And he didn't just kiss him once. The language says that he kissed him over and over and over again on his neck. In a small community, farms are built around villages. It's likely that the son would have to travel through the village to get to his father's house, or at least skirt the outside of the village on his journey home. Families working in the field or at the wells would see him coming. The community was like an extended family, and one of their respected elders had been very disrespected. it would not be a warm reception from the community. Children that treated their parents this way were flat out stoned to death. And that was probably going to be the fate of this wayward son. If the famine and starvation hadn't finished him off, the elders of the village were going to get their licks in. It was to dissuade any of their own children from following in the path of this son. His own father would be expected to do the same for any of the other families that might be in the same situation. But the son could not know that while he had been gone, his father watched patiently for his return, not simply going about everyday business, hoping for his son to come through the door, but by being vigilant and watchful on his lookout. If the villagers caught the son first, they would kill him. Kill him before his father had a chance to rescue him. And that day had finally arrived. The father sees his son a great way off. The father, too, has rehearsed his actions. The father runs to his son, and the word for run is actually raced. He would have had to have lifted his long robe, showing the nakedness of his legs, for all to observe. This was more scandalous than the son's earlier actions. The father did not run merely to greet his son, though he wanted to do that, but he runs to prevent the village from executing the justice that is required on his son. The father will be the first to meet the returning son and embrace him publicly. The embrace and public demonstration, falling on his neck and kissing him over and over, would broadcast to everyone that his son is under his father's protection and forgiveness. There will be no repercussions inflicted on this prodigal. Reconciliation is swift and breathtaking. It would catch everyone watching by surprise. But what is the cost the father has paid? In the beginning, privately, when the son rebelled and demanded his inheritance, and now publicly, the father's love is naked before all to see. In verse 21, and the son said to the father, I have sinned against heaven and in thy sight, and I am no more worthy to be called thy son. But the father said to the servant, bring forth the best robe and put it on him, put a ring on his hand and shoes on his feet. The son begins his speech, but then he throws himself on the mercy of his father. He omits the part about make me as one of thy hired servants. He no longer wants to negotiate a deal. He stops trying to save himself with his own works. He surrenders his fate completely into his father's hands. And again, publicly, the father declares his love for his son. The best robe is the first robe, protos, first in order. That's the robe to be worn by the master of the house. The ring put on his hand is the signet ring of the father, of the master of the house. It tells all that the son has the right to act in the father's name. And the shoes on his feet signifies the complete restoration of sonship. Servants and slaves went barefoot. Free men wore sandals on their feet. All rights and privileges of sonship are publicly restored. In verse 33, it says, and bring hither the fatted calf and kill it, and let us eat and be merry. For my son was dead and is alive again. He is lost and found, and they began to be merry. The whole community would have been invited to join the feast. The entire village would have returned to the father's house, perhaps 100 to 200 people. And the fatted calf with all the trimmings were prepared and cooked. It was an all-day event. It would have been a communal gathering and effort. The festivities would have culminated with a feast. That would be at the night meal. The father would declare, for this my son was dead and is alive again. He is lost and he is found. It's another bold public statement. The father knew what the outcome of his son's actions would be. He would probably be found dead. The father watched expectantly for a dead son. But now life is restored. He is reborn. His dead son is alive. His lost son is found. And they began to be in Mary. Verse 25, it says, and now when the elder son was in the field, and he came and he drew nigh to the house, He heard the music and the dancing, and he called to one of the servants and asked what these things meant. And he said unto him, Thy brother is come, thy father has killed the fatted calf, because he has received him safe and sound. And the elder son was angry, and he would not go in. Therefore his father came out and entreated him. The older brother, the firstborn, the son who stayed home in the midst of the scandal, the faithful son who continued to mind the store, the good son, right? He hears the party music, the salsa dancing, the merriment. He asks one of the servants what these things meant. He finds out that his brother has returned from the far country. The elder son is no longer able to contain his resentment, and he was angry and he would not go in. His countenance must have changed, or perhaps he just blurted up out of frustration. I'm going to give you a little spoiler alert about the next verse. The older brother knew what his younger brother was up to the entire time he was gone. How else did he know that his brother hath devoured his father's living with harlots? If the brother knew, the father knew. Perhaps this was part of his motivation for watching out for his son's return. Now he has returned, and the older brother is fuming. He learns that a party is in reconciliation and restoration for his brother. He probably too has rehearsed in his head what his father would do when this day came, imagining his little brother groveling at the feet of his father, perhaps even kissing his father's feet, begging for mercy, while the father bragged about the older good son. Whatever the case is, the father observes that he is not part of the festival. The older brother was to be the host, the maitre d', serving all of the seated guests. His father would relax and mingle and socialize among the guests. In this case, he would be rejoicing. His refusal is another rebellious son insulting the father, but now it's in public. Though this son never left the house physically, he couldn't have been any farther away from his father. The father seeks out his elder son, not in an accusatory or challenging way, but in a heart of compassion, in a heart of love, and he entreated him. And the word for entreat is the same word that is used for the comforter, the Holy Spirit, the Parakletos. He comes alongside of his son to comfort him. The father intercedes for his sons, plural. In verse 29, the older brother, answering, said to his father, Lo, these many years do I serve thee, neither I transgressed at any time thy commandment. And yet thou never gavest me a kid that I might make merry with my friends. But as soon as this thy son is come, which hath devoured thy living with harlots, thou hast killed for him the fatted calf. How many of you have ever said, Look you, to your father, and were able to get the next words out of your mouth before he clocked you? This is what this son starts his conversation off with. Look you, I've served you these many years. And the word for serve is slave. He tells his father that he's been a slave for these many years, which is an outright lie and a great insult. There was never a master-slave relationship between them. It has always been that of a loving father and an obedient, dutiful son. This diatribe he delivers is directed towards his father. What the younger brother did was disrespectful to the father, but he did it out of the lust of his flesh and youthful immaturity. The older brother's disrespect is out of resentment in his heart towards his father. He thinks his father the fool for his actions, both in the beginning and now at the end. The older brother, he's been a prodigal longer than his younger brother. His true colors come out in front of everybody, including his younger brother. He resents his father's forgiveness towards him. He forgets how much he himself has received. He disowns his father verbally, as he has already done in his heart. He says, Look you, instead of addressing him as father, saying, I am a slave, instead of, I am your son. saying, I deserve the celebration, but you ignored me and my friends. But as soon as thy son has come, not saying as soon as my brother has come, he came after he parted away all thy money with prostitutes and whores, and for him you kill the fatted calf? This stuff must have just vomited out of his mouth, right in the father's face. The father came alongside to comfort his son, but the son would have turned to his father in a face-to-face confrontation, and one by one the son stabs his father in the heart with his hateful words. Which of us hasn't had a public meltdown by one of our children? The embarrassment, the feeling that all eyes are watching us. But the father extends love and mercy and grace. He reassures his son that he has never stopped loving him or his brother. In verse 31, he says, and he said to him, son, thou art ever with me, and all that I have is thine. It was necessary that we make merry and be glad, for this thy brother was dead and is alive again, and was lost and is found. The father has long suffered two sons who wished him dead, one through his actions, the other through his words. The father bears the disgrace and the shame from another of his sons. He leaves the celebration to rescue him. He reassures him, calling him, son, thou art ever with me. Everything that I have is yours. No good thing have I withheld. What is the cost of grace? Each son has cost the father his wealth. The father entrusted all he had to his sons, given freely and without reservation. He would not go back and undo his decision. His word was his bond. If the sons mishandled the portions given to them, the father honors their decision. It cost him his public reputation. All knew of the young son and his misdeeds. All witnessed the oldest son and his reproach. Yet the father publicly reaches out to his sons. They are his sons. He bears the burden of their sins. He initiates reconciliation. His selflessness is without concerns of what other people thought. It cost his personal dignity. The father would rather bear the shame himself than see his boys lost to the world. The public nakedness of his legs, the public nakedness of the conversation. The father initiates to each son restoration. Forgiveness is offered for offense. Love is offered for hatred. Mercy is offered for justice. Grace is offered for cruelty. It cost him his family name. Each of the brothers' actions would disqualify the whole family. No one would give their daughter to a younger son who caroused with Gentile prostitutes, or to a son of birthright that disrespected the father publicly. If there were daughters in the family, they would be shunned. No one would trust a dowry to men like these, but the father still calls each of them my son. It cost him his family dynasty. The inheritance was not for sale, as the younger son did. It was meant to be passed on from generation to generation. The prodigal's father had received it from his father, and his father from his father, and his father from his father, all the way back to the beginning of the family tree. And the sons were to exercise great care in preserving it for their children and for their future grandchildren and great-grandchildren. The actions of each of these sons would bring an end to the family line. Not once did the father reprimand or reject. Instead, he offered the patience, the favor, the mercy, the grace that they didn't deserve. The father gave these willingly. Love requires a determinate action. It requires a sacrifice. It must be given. You cannot hold on to love. And that is what grace is. Grace is love that is given. Grace is very expensive. It costs the giver a price the receiver can never comprehend. Yet what cost everything is given freely. Grace is selfless, generous, lavish. It is the example that Jesus gives to us. He expects us to do likewise. Worship team, you guys can come up. Though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels, but I have not love, I have become a sounding brass and a clanging cymbal. And though I have the gift of prophecy and I understand the mysteries and all knowledge, and though I have all faith, so that I could even remove mountains, but have not love, I am nothing. And though I bestow my goods to feed the poor, and though I give my body to be burned, but have not love, it profits me nothing.